This week our guest is Bandana Tiwari. She's a lifestyle editor, badass sustainability activist, and formerly held the position of editor-at-large as well as fashion features director for Vogue India. She now writes for Business of Fashion and speaks internationally on India's fashion craft traditions as well as the lessons of Gandhi and the Khadi movement. In this episode, we talk about everything from spirituality and fashion to the Western world's long history of appropriation and extractive relationships with Indian and other cultures, to the place and importance of culture and diversity moving forward. It's a rich and deep conversation, and I hope you get as much out of it as I did. On to this week's episode.
Spirit of Design delves deep into the unseen elements of design and holistic sustainability.
Join us, Amy and
Anya,
for open conversations with creatives, scholars, activists, and others to envision alternative design futures that are diverse, inclusive, community-centric, and in symbiosis with all life on this planet. Welcome, Bandana, to Spirit of Design podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It's such a privilege.
Privilege is all mine. So throughout your career, you've held a lot of prestigious roles, such as editor at large, as well as fashion features director of Vogue India. But what really excites me about speaking to you today is that when it comes to the conversation of sustainability and fashion, I feel like in this sea of kind of monotonous voices that are all singing really essentially the same song, there's this harmony that I hear you carrying that speaks to the possibilities of a more holistic future. And for me, I find that really exciting. And so I'm really excited to dive into that. And also from the 0.0000.5% insight I have had into your life through social media and your writing, I perceive you as such a badass, breaking social norms and being bold with your life. And I love badass women. And so, you know, personally, I find that very exciting.
Yeah, I am a badass sustainability activist. I really am. And I feel, you know, I feel we need to bring a certain amount of reality and authenticity to whatever journey we are on. And I am a big fan of activists who've been in the business for 20, 30 years. There's superb academics who know 100 times more than I do. So I made a decision early in my life to figure out what would my contribution be as a singular human being. And this is not to say I'm going to be this overarching change that's so pompous. It is, what can I do personally? And this is where I found it very easy to go back to, let's say, the Gandhian philosophy, which is a belief, deep belief, that social change and activism comes from personal responsibility. So when you start looking at your own life and seeing what kind of voice you can lend to activism, what kind of changes that you can make, that will aid your sustainable life on a personal level, then, you know, life becomes quite simple. I can talk about sustainability in terms of my spiritual practice, my meditation, my nature worship, my full moon ceremonies, to buying less, to encouraging people to buying less, to affecting my own community of friends and peers, to be able to write authentically, to choosing to write about topics that matter to me, when as a writer, you know that I can go on to different mediums and write about a lot of things which sound fancy but have less meaning. So those are all changes I can bring within myself. And I encourage people to do that because Otherwise, sustainability becomes something that someone else will solve for you, you know? Mm. It just mm-hmm. becomes a very amorphous, undefinable word that we always expect someone else to understand better and implement for you, so we don't then take personal ownership. So it's a very simple way of looking at sustainability, and it works for me. And when it works for me and I feel quite joyful about it and I can share my message, I hope it can be joyful for others.
Mm, I love that. And I think that's such an important part of, like, an important part to bring into this is the joyfulness aspect of it, because I feel like sometimes that's missing. We almost feel like as if sustainability is something that you give up, or, you know, it's something you sacrifice for, but it can be deeply joyful and very much a, I find in my own personal life, it can be something that makes me feel very, I don't know, it arises out of my connection to deeper, more meaningful things in my life.
Absolutely. It's just a change in perspective. Mm. You know, imagine you are going to be telling teenagers, if you make a small change in your life, you are protecting, nourishing, nurturing the environment. And that is such a wonderful thing to do. There's nothing to be afraid of when we talk about sustainability the way, I mean, it's been talked about. I know it can get frightful. So I love talk. I have a 17-year-old teenage daughter, and I have tons of teenagers in my house all the time, at least pre-COVID. And they're all social activists in their own rights, because they go to a sustainable school, but they have really actualized what sustainability means. So it is about whether understanding that when you're wearing leather, it's not just about killing a cow that is killed not for its meat and the leather becomes a byproduct. It is taking away acres and acres of land for animal husbandry that only caters to killing animals because you need the leather, nothing else. And so just they internalize these stories, and they've taught me a lot about how to make these big, broad statements about sustainable living into something that is a very personal act in my everyday choices. And when you make that into something that you can live and breathe every day and understand it in a holistic way, then small changes can be implemented. And I think, you know, for me, it is really the units that make a whole. So personal change leads to collective change, can lead to changes in a nation.
Yeah, I've heard you speak a lot about this conscious consumption and personal responsibility in your work, as I've read through it and listened to your various interviews that you've done. And I 100% agree with you that personal responsibility is essential, and it is those small changes, and it is that sense of personal responsibility. But I also feel like sometimes we forget to address that there is this spiritual, cultural, community deficit that most people in the developed world face today. And this whole idea of conscious consumption remains dependent upon the consumer's willpower to choose kind of the greater good over this individual pleasure.
Well, I think, you know, I think I know where you're going, because we talk about conscious consumption. It's almost like an oxymoron, right? Because there's the consciousness part of it and there is consumption. But when you put the two together, in my very, very humble opinion, I feel the moment you say conscious, then it means that it is about the self, your mind, body, and soul, right? So you are not just you know, a robotic consumer that is being fed everything, and you are beholden to a marketing entity that tells you what to do, as if you don't have a mind of your own. So the moment you put the conscious into consumption, then you take ownership over what your mind perceives and what it chooses to consume. So when you bring the conscious part of it, then it requires a level of self-evaluation. That do I really need the things that I purchase? How much do I need? How much do I need to consume to fuel my vanity? What props me up as a human being? Things, emotions, or sense of well-being that is holistic? So when you say conscious consumption, it invites you into a world where you have to reevaluate yourself before you do anything that participates in a consuming world. And so for me, that is very important because we will always be consumers. We should be consumers because we are creative human beings. There's so much beauty in the world, in the aesthetic stuff that we can buy. But if we can bring the consciousness into our buying practice, for instance, then we are more cognizant of the things that we buy and how we will value them. Hence, we will not throw them away. And therefore, that will hopefully make us understand that when we throw things, then they go into landfills, and landfills corrupt the environment. So it's such a beautiful, organic way of looking at the self that is microcosmic, and then moving outward into a world that is macrocosmic. And that is a beautiful cycle that we can complete for ourselves. And that is obviously about personal evaluation and personal responsibility.
Agreed. I think that's exactly what I was getting at, was that I think there's this, it comes down to that personal evaluation. Like in my personal life, I've noticed that in the times when, like when I was younger, consumed just insane amounts of clothing every weekend for every event, and you know, and I wasn't conscious of what my consumer habits was. I think I also had this sense of, and this is just my own personal experience, I had this sense of having a lack that was being met by products. And I agree with you that I don't think we should not be consumers. I think fashion is such an incredible industry. I think that we should support artisans who are, and designers who are making beautiful products. I believe that fashion is almost as if it's this translation of the divine into a physical product when it's done well.
Absolutely. And so we need to value.
I think that's.
Sorry, go on.
No, you go for it.
So I was just thinking, you know, if we start looking at creativity as a spiritual practice, right? Then you tend to veer towards creativity in a very sacred way. And you look around the world, whatever things that we buy, consume, whatever, someone has put their heart, mind, and soul into making something of a beautiful design. We turn them into products. We forgot the process. So the idea of our, the ideas of value then is only about the beauty of a product, not the beauty of the process, not the beauty of the people behind that process. And I think now with living with this endless fear of dying in COVID and the virus and what have you, it makes you really think about what is our purpose in life. Now, if we take life as a creative force, then creativity has to be questioned within us and say, what is the purpose of my creativity? What is that is going to give us value to that creativity? So we forgot to have this conversation in the process of manufacturing and producing in abundance, so that more and more, bigger is better, faster, not fewer. But time was irrelevant. Time was, you were only, like, look at the manufacturers and the producers in Bangladesh right now. They're only valued for the time that they clock in to make a product. It is not the value of the people, their culture, their, it is not about them at all. It is only about how many things they can produce within that short period of time. And that's how you get paid. And that has led to an abysmal dysfunctioning of the entire fashion supply chain, where we've forgotten that there's a process that brings people and products together. But we only thought about the products, and we only thought about the numbers. And so for me, if we don't look at creativity as not just product, but process and purpose, then we will continue to live this life where we disrespect others, where the systems have become so dysfunctional that they can disintegrate over a virus, which is a flu virus, the entire world system disintegrated. And that's how badly we had constructed our systems of production and manufacturing. Today, Bangladesh is at the mercy of a handful of top brands that have created billions of dollars of wealth for themselves while paying pittance to the economic and social health of the very people who have made them rich.
Yeah, it's almost as though this stripping of the sacredness of the, I guess, the creation of tangible, you know, goods in terms of like in fashion and garments.
Yes, you're
has
right.
Has led to this point.
No, I was just saying, you were saying stripping off, right? So today it's so blatant. Every day I'm reading about how factory workers have been so marginalized now, they're going to go into deeper poverty. So my first question that comes to me is not about the systems. I ask, where is their compassion? When did they stop becoming human beings? So, you know, I don't ask, yes, the systems have to change. But for me, at a fundamental level, I'm asking, how did you become so disengaged with human suffering? Where did your compassion go? You know, this is where talking about spirituality comes hand to hand, hand in glove with sustainability. We have to ask real questions about humanity and the human condition. It just can't be these big esoteric words that lead to nothing and, you know, greenwashing and what have you. We need to talk about humanity, compassion, mindfulness, because we're reaching out as human beings to other human beings. We are interconnected in the way we feel our emotions. So let's just start from there first.
Yeah, 100%. Ugh, big stuff. so I guess where do you think that where would you start? Because sometimes I think these conversations can feel very foreign to us if we're not used to the idea of, I mean, in the West, everything is so compartmentalized. You've got a box for your spirituality, you've got a box for your work, a box for your personal life, a box for fashion, and none of them merge together. And I think, I guess personally, coming from Indigenous culture, and I don't know if it's the same for you coming from Indian culture, they merge a little bit more easily, and those concepts touch each other and bump into each other.
What's your Indigenous culture?
I'm Maori. So I'm amazing. New Zealand Indigenous Maori, and then my mom is European, but I grew up in Central Asia.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, I'm Nepalese. My mother and father are both originally from Nepal. I grew up in India. I grew up in the Himalayas. I was born in a beautiful village, in a farm, my grandfather's farm, in a place called Sikkim, which is literally couched in between Nepal, Tibet, Bhutan, India, and Sikkim became part of India in 1972. So we live with nature, we live with animism, we live with nature worshipping. So for me, it's such a natural progression. And, you know, just earlier on, you were saying in the West, people live in compartments. You know, you have the yoga you, and then you have the Wall Street you, then you have this you. So maybe a great way to start, you know, individually is to shatter those compartments. You are one human being with so many things to offer and so many, maybe there are compartments in your brains that need to be shattered, because it's the same person that is indulging in so many things in the journey of life. But I personally feel that that comes from a sense of well-being that can be explored through meditation, living closer to nature, not taking nature for granted. I come from the fashion world. I can't tell you the joy that I get not wearing heels, for instance. Simple thing like that. So simple that I can walk barefoot on the grass and you get used to it. And the moment your body is touching any element of nature, then you know, you're appreciative of it. Suddenly I discover how beautiful the tree in front of me is. You know, a lot of people have to do psychedelic drugs to get into the state of appreciation, right? to love nature. But I think just shedding off some of the bullshit that we have clouded our minds and bodies with, just once in a while as a meditative practice, opens your eyes and opens your consciousness in a real way in your everyday lives. Not wearing makeup, for instance, for a while, you know, it makes such a big impact on. I have a friend who's staying with me from Brussels, and she's been on lockdown with me in Bali, and she doesn't wear makeup at all in her face, and she glows, and she's appreciating this lack of a better word, this clean face. You know, it's almost like you just stripped off a skin that you had to put on over and over again, and just facing nature with your truthfulness, your nakedness. And sorry, my phone just rang.
No worries.
Just being able to be naked in small ways in our daily lives. So I find that enriching, empowering, and you know, gives me a little skip in my work, because there's such small little ways to be more engaged in your surroundings and live in the moment.
100%. I feel like you need a sense of humility as well for that, as you were saying, stripping of kind of almost the mask of makeup and the removal of things like the heels, which is almost like an identity. It's almost like we need some sense of humility when we approach, that kind of relationship with the natural world. And
this is not to say we shouldn't appreciate. Trust me, I'm a party girl. I can't wait for the clubs to open. I can't wait to wear my heels. Yeah, I want to wear my boas and my feathers, and I want to put makeup on and like just go out and rule the night. I am so appreciative of the fact that I can do that, as well as walk barefoot, be bohemian, and not give a shit about what marketeers have told me to be over and over again, especially as a woman. You know, I gave a talk recently, and we were talking about, you know, what's the uniform of today? Very typically of fashion, we want to find the uniform for every damn situation, right? And I'm like, I'm actually tired of this idea that a woman has to be so many different persons by what she wears. So if she's going to work, then she has to wear those work clothes. When she's going to a cocktail party, it's the cocktail dress. When she goes for a sit-down dinner, it's like, you know, black tie dressing. Then there's the red carpet. It's as if I'm expected to be 3-4 types of women in a day. And I have to change my clothes constantly to portray that, just to satisfy a consumerist marketing world that makes me buy more and more based on how many times they're going to split my personality in the course of the day. So I do not subscribe to that anymore. I will go to a party wearing clothes that I could wear to work, and I will go to work wearing party clothes. I mean, I refuse to be defined by this anymore. So I don't worry about, if I am going to wear my heels, if I'm going to wear my makeup, it's because I choose to, because I feel flamboyant, not because I'm catering to an agenda that has been so brutally disgraceful for women. And we are raising women today and making them believe that that's the norm. I think that's got to change. That's got to change.
Amen. I guess that's just a physical expression of that compartmentalization, though. It's like, here, you compartmentalize yourself here, there, and there. But it's just, I think there's something really freeing about allowing yourself to be all of it, however it expresses itself in this moment. And there's a freedom to that. And I think it kind of informs the way you live in a broader sense. When you allow yourself that freedom, it's when you become less judgmental of yourself in that way. That's just my experience with it.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right.
Amazing. So, okay, I had this question because I'm very curious about this. But it seems to me that when we in the West are kind of thinking about India, we have this kind of really incredibly extractive attitude towards India. And we think of it as this place we go to take from, and not just India, but, you know, southern, Asia. Non-Western countries in general, Asia. And we think of it as this place we go to take from labor and resources and fibers and artisanal crafts and inspiration. But in the case of India, it's so much more than that. And I heard you share recently on a podcast that India is this land of Ayurveda and yoga with this rich, beautiful history and so much wisdom to share when it comes to kind of our understanding of sustainability. And I just wanted to know what you thought we could learn from Indian culture without being appropriative, first of all, but also how can we look to India for leadership and how can Western brands work with Indian artisans in a way that's honoring? Because I feel like this is, it's important to stop considering the rest of our world as our, is just a place to take from.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. We've been living in a world where developed nations have pillaged the creativity, the economy of developing nations, and forgotten that most of these countries that they refer to, for whether it's for resources, for materials, for artisan skills, these are thousands of years old cultures, civilizations. Mm. India is 5,000 years old. Do you want to know how old is America? So this is not to take away the importance and the value of the American culture, but when big Western brands or Western companies, governments come and do business in my part of the world, that is, you know, Southeast Asia, Indian subcontinent, it seriously feels like they are dipping into it only for cheap labor resources and not giving enough compensation that would be respectful. You wouldn't dare do that in your own country. We know what fair wages are in the Western world, but it's a completely different story in my part of the world. And this boils down to a power structure that is dysfunctional because it is based entirely on a consumerist agenda, so not on a cultural agenda. Now, were it to be defined by culture, heritage, provenance, you name it, then there is no beating countries in Asia and India, right? And because, I mean, you know, I grew up in India. It is insanely wise. Vedanta, like we have something called Vedic heritage, which is the wisdom of the past. Very secular, very secular, non-political. You can be an atheist and you can be a Vedanta scholar. Okay? And when you grow up with that kind of wisdom, which is so holistic, the wisdom of Vedanta literally puts together environment and the people in one place, and the philosophy of how to be a good human being. We grow up with those sentiments, and then to have big brands or very, very affluent Western nations come and just cherry pick what works for them. That is disrespectful. You need to dive in culturally, be immersive in the cultures of the people that support your business. Otherwise, this transaction is dysfunctional. And we can see now why this transaction didn't work. The idea of globalization, that I could pick up a shirt where the buttons come from China, the embroidery is done in India, and the cotton is farmed in Bangladesh, and I'm going to pay $3 for it. That level of globalization disrespected humanity of creativity, right? And so if you don't delve into the cultural heritage of the countries that you're producing from, then I don't think you have a business that can survive. And we can see that right now. In fact, I feel very optimistic for brands and designers who have been working within their own ecosystems, working with their own cultural heritage, being inspired by other cultures, but then relying on their own ecosystem to produce, manufacture, create, and give a level of humanity to their processes. I find them to be more engaging, and perhaps they will last. They may not have to have the kind of failures that multi-billion-dollar companies have today, when you have to shut all their shops all over the world. You know, a chain of faceless shops that just mushroomed all over the world in the name of consumerism. They are all closed today. Now, that system doesn't work. I think the systems that work are, which are mindful of the environment you're in, brands that are culturally immersed in the well-being of the people, honoring the crafts. I feel optimistic for those brands. So bigger is not always better.
I find it really interesting as well that you just touched on the importance of cultural and respect for culture, because I think one of the things that I find incredibly frustrating in the sustainability space is that it is very Western-centric. Like, the solutions that we're looking at, the conversations that we're having, tend to be very Western-centric conversations. And so I'm interested to know where you think the place of culture is in this conversation moving forward, because I kind of feel like, as though when you look at the natural world and you look at ecosystems, what an ecosystem requires in order to thrive is diversity. And I feel like our fashion ecosystems are lacking in cultural diversity, because we're so worried about being PC, and we're all, everyone's favorite comment is that we're all one, so it's okay, we all share everything. And yes, we're one, but we also have diverse histories and cultures, and that's beautiful and important, because it informs different perspectives and a diverse ecosystem. I don't know what your opinion is here.
I have a huge opinion on this.
Yes, please share.
So, you know, just recently, just pre-COVID, it was World Intellectual Property Rights Day. Okay, now let me explain what that is. So we all know about intellectual property rights. And a very, very dear friend of mine and an activist started a project, her own initiative called Cultural Intellectual Property Rights. So she added culture to intellectual property rights, because world over we were seeing plagiarism of cultural symbols, cultural patterns being used by big brands where there was no credit given to the source, right? So we've seen it with the best. We've seen it with the Dior's and the Gucci's and you name it. They're all there who have sort of abused the cultural nuances of very old cultures and given zero credit. So I was asked to write a little bit, and it's just three paragraphs. Can I read out?
Yes, please.
Okay, so I had to write about what I felt, and I just opened this page because, it just popped up miraculously. I wrote, clothes are visual maps of the human condition. Whether it's the many tribes in remote islands of Flores in Indonesia or Nagaland in Northeast India, the type of weave, print, color combination all signify the identity and the dignity of its people. It is a display of the variety, diversity, and brilliant multi-layered spectrum of the indigenous cultures of the world. It is the kind of clothing and craftsmanship that invokes spirituality, animism, responsibility, and respect. Products that enhance and nourish our mental and emotional health. I'm talking about items of beauty made with soul and purpose. Culture is the backbone of every country. If you want to participate in the global sustainability drive, we need to be in the forefront of the discourse propagated by cultural intellectual property rights. That's the triple C mechanism: consent, due credit, and fair compensation. CCC, credit, consent, compensation. They have to be adhered to. Else, if we dismiss culture, we dismiss the importance of time, provenance, heritage, and integrity. But if we respect the sacredness of different cultures all over the world, we can believe that even with cultural differences, the common humanity of love can thrive. End.
I love that. That's beautiful.
So it boils down to respect. This is not about, that we don't embrace diversity. globalization allowed us to participate in everyone else's cultures, and it was great. But globalization also created a sense of speed where we just dipped our fingers into culture. We didn't immerse ourselves in it. So we became a parody of Instagram posts, you know? You just land up in Venice so you can be seen with a gondola, but it didn't matter that you didn't want to eat the authentic Italian food, understand the making of the Murano glass, whatever, the beautiful culture, the hundreds of things that their culture offers. So we made it into a very stilted understanding of what culture means, which is short-lived, short-circuited, and we didn't value it. Now that we can't travel, or even if we do post-COVID, we're going to be traveling less. So my hope and understanding is that when we travel now, we will have to be much more culturally immersed in other cultures in a much more authentic way, with also a way of seeing how we can engage with the culture. How can we give back? Is there something that I can support in my travels to do some good, some social good, while I have a great time traveling and enjoying somebody else's culture and their heritage? I hope that's the way that people are going to travel. It can't be the way we were traveling, and I'm as guilty as any other person, dipping in and dipping out 2 days, 3 days, you know, and pretending that I knew everything about a country or their culture just because I spent 3 days in one city. So I think the purpose of the idea of talking about culture now is that it's got to be a much more engaged, mindful, authentic association so we can co-create in the future, not just pillage without consent, credit, and compensation.
Agreed. Yeah, and I also think that when we're having these conversations around sustainability and we're having these big you know, conferences and stuff, it's in, I think there's a place for culture there as well, but in a self-represented kind of way, where you know, more voices are included at the table, because I think there's just, you know, in these spaces, we're not talking about things like spirituality or and having deeper, more nuanced conversations. And that's the, that's one of the values that I believe that culture brings and different perspectives bring. And so,
yeah. And you know, you're Maori, you know, that you cannot talk about, you know, your race without talking about spirituality and culture, right? It's impossible to understand the Maori culture if you don't veer in that direction. So with the same thing with sustainability, on the one hand, I love sustainability that is about technology and innovation. I absolutely love it that we can have leather that is made out of wine waste, that we have silks made out of crop waste, that we've got clothes that can grow as the child grows. That's innovation that blows my mind, and I absolutely love it. So it's wonderful that is happening in the one end of the spectrum. But on the other end of the spectrum, we have to be very realistic about cultures that are especially indigenous cultures who don't have the wherewithal to think about technology and innovation in terms of sustainability, right? So to give you an example, countries like India, Indonesia, in fact, most of Asia, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, you name it. What does sustainability mean in cultures where innovation is not top of mind because we don't have the kind of research and development and monies put into schools and institutes that teach technology and innovation? We have lived with the ideas of cultural sustainability for the longest time. The birth of these nations were based on cultural sustainability, which meant that these cultures were rural economies. They were grassroots economies, and they were the nations were built because of village economies, like a pyramid that started from ground up. Okay? So, and these villages, as Gandhi pointed out over and over again in his talks and speeches all over the world, and his quest for independence for India, was believe in the units that make a whole, the villages that make a country. He was a political anarchist. He wanted to give he wanted to call them village republics. He did not believe in a centralized government. He wanted to empower villages as little states of their own, because he realized that every village had their own ecosystem that flourished when they catered to their own ecosystems. So they had their own dyers, weavers, cobblers, and they thrived, and the excess would be sold or traded to the next village, and the next village would do that, and it created such an incredibly rich economy pre-colonization that the GDP of India's global output to the GDP of the world was, at that time, before colonization, it was 23%. After colonization, do you know what it was? After colonization, when they uprooted the Indian economy because they killed the village economy, they started by killing the British colonizers, killed the rural economy. They knew where to hurt the most. They went straight to the village economy. By the time they left, when the country had been sabotaged by greed, it contributed 2% to the global GDP. Wow. So from being an extremely affluent country, and it was affluent because it believed in the village economy of creativity and consumption that looked after its people, its ecology, and its environment. And so it was holistic. I can go on and on about this, but that those are the systems that became redundant because of consumerism.
I think that's a lot. I think in this sustainability space, like you said, there's the tech stuff on one side, but I feel like from cultures, like just as you've spoken about, and from indigenous cultures, there's so much that we can learn in terms of that intimate knowledge of how to live in harmony with the land and how to be self-sustaining, and even how to have that inner kind of spiritual sustainability. I feel like all of it added up creates the puzzle, but we currently have maybe one or two puzzle pieces, and we think that, and we're just beating our heads against the wall trying to figure out why it's not coming together. I think it's
Because it's imperative that we bring in cultural sustainability at the forefront, because a big chunk of the world is going to be disassociated from all these conferences because it doesn't resonate with countries like Asia and India, countries in Asia and countries like India and Sri Lanka and all that, right? It doesn't resonate, because if you talk to us about what sustainability means within our cultural context, then I can resonate with it and I can make changes. But if you talk to us about sustainability, which sounds like a sci-fi film because it's so innovative and so tech smart, then I'm just like going to be wide-eyed and gobsmacked, and I will not be able to participate. In fact, it may even distance me. So we need to have the notions and the ideals of cultural sustainability resurrected so that it works for a massive chunk of the earth that actually produces for the richest countries in the world.
It was at this point of our interview that our tech gave out, but Bandana ended by sharing a message that was heavy on her heart. She ended by sharing that if you've ever watched one of her TED Talks or you've seen her speak live, you would have heard her encourage all of us to go on a fashion diet, to stop buying clothes, to make do with what we have. But post-COVID-19, she encourages each of us to go out and support small, ethical, and sustainable brands with our purchases. A huge thanks to Bandana for her time and her wisdom, and I hope you enjoyed today's episode as much as I did.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this week's conversation.
For today's show notes, to get in touch or sign up to our mailing list, you can find links at the bottom of this episode page.
And if you are new to our community, then head on over to our Instagram at sustainability5.0 and our website www.sustainability5.world, and follow along to stay up to date with our upcoming online and in-person events.
If you found value in today's conversation, then we would so appreciate it if you would subscribe and leave us a review. Through this, you're helping others to find these important conversations.
Have a wonderful week. Bye-bye.